This is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. An alarming number of Ohioans involved in right-wing extremist acts in recent years, from James Alex Fields, who killed Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, to Daily Stormer neo-Nazi website founder Andrew Anglin, to multiple people arrested after the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Let's talk about all that. Joining us now is Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism Senior Research Fellow, Dr. Mark Pitcavage. Dr. Pitcavage, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Mark, you were quoted in a recent Cleveland.com story as saying that you're concerned about a new type of extremism that may have arisen last year, may continue to flourish. You talked about some of the people who stormed the U.S. Capitol back in January who were, quote, so fanatic about Trump, so caught up in his cult of personality, so invested in his conspiracy theories that they were willing to put Trump above party, country, and law and order. Could you elaborate a little bit on this new type of extremism as you see it?
Sure. Or potential new type of extremism, I guess I should say. We're all familiar with a variety of traditional types of extremists in the United States, groups or movements that have been around with us for decades, including a variety of different types of white supremacists, anti-government extremists ranging from militia groups to sovereign citizens, and single-issue extremists like anti-abortion extremists, just to name a few. When we look at the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, we see a lot of people from traditional extremist groups, anti-government extremists, a few white supremacists, a variety of conspiracy theorists, the Proud Boys. But we also see people who didn't have any previous connections to known extremist groups or movements, but who appeared to be there as a particular type of Trump supporter, not just a Trump supporter or even a hardcore Trump supporter, but someone who had become so wrapped up in a cult of personality centered around Donald Trump and so caught up in conspiracy theories and lies promulgated by Trump and a number of his lieutenants over the election and over other matters, that they had essentially become radicalized, certainly radicalized to the point where, as we all saw on TV, hundreds of them were actually willing to storm the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. And, you know, it's a real open question as to, you know, how many people are there like this out there and whether they might pose a threat of some future violence or whether, now that Trump is no longer president, they might actually fade away over time. It's a concerning matter.
You note the anti-abortion extremists from the past and to some degree the present as well, other anti-government extremists that we've seen in the news over the past couple of decades, but they never really had the impact of storming the United States Congress in the way that they did in this dangerous, violent, and shocking attack on one of our nation's main centers of our government. What's different now, do you think? What is it that's different about this type of extremism that is emerging that drew so many people not just to make a tweet, make a Facebook comment, talk about something at their dinner table, but to actually go to the nation's capital and take up arms against the government?
Well, certainly for at least some of them, they didn't necessarily go to the Capitol with that intention, but probably got swept up in the moment. But we also know that there were those who, you know, actually did have a plan or some semblance of a plan or at least a broad goal or objective, you know, to do something to, you know, sort of obstruct the certification of the Electoral College in Congress. This certainly was an unusual thing. And one of the things that was one of the reasons why it occurred in the first place was because it was an example not just of extremist violence, but of political violence. And, you know, this is something that, we have seen past examples of on both the right and the left where people who did not have previous ties to other types of extremism engaged in significant political violence. For example, the baseball field attack that injured Steve Scalise, or Cesar Sayoc, the man who sent the pipe bombs to all of Trump's perceived enemies. But, you know, this was an incident where it wasn't an isolated individual, but hundreds of people coming together to engage in political violence. And most, you know, if you look at U.S. history and you look at political violence, most of our political violence in recent decades has actually come from the fringes. It has come from extremist groups and movements. But when the pool of people willing to engage in political violence becomes starts to extend beyond just the fringes or, you know, extreme groups and movements, you know, into what would previously have been considered sort of mainstream political positions, at least, you know, more or less, you know, that becomes very worrisome because it leaves open the possibility of many more acts of violence, a much broader pool of people possibly willing to engage in violence for political or ideological reasons.
So we are seeing some polling that indicates a significant majority of Republicans, people who identify as Republicans, suggesting that the 2020 election was stolen. And it was that message that drew this crowd to Washington, D.C. on behalf of former President Donald Trump and then to invade the Capitol building. How has this version of extremism managed to infiltrate what had been one of the two mainstream political parties?
Well, I don't think it infiltrated the Republican Party. I mean, it essentially emerges from within the Republican Party and other Trump supporters who may not actually formally be Republicans. You know, among the very large pool of people who support Donald Trump, you know, there exists some who go a lot further than simply supporting Donald Trump, but, you know, who essentially view Trump as a savior, view Trump as a solution to every problem, who view Trump as someone who can do no wrong and who are willing to believe every utterance from Donald Trump, you know, no matter whether, you know, whether they're accurate or whether they're well documented as being untrue. And it's this, you know, it's this following that has developed, you know, really centered around a cult of personality, which is rather disturbing.
We are talking with Dr. Mark Pitkovich, and you're based in Columbus, right?
Yes.
And he is with the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism, where he is a senior research fellow. You've got a lot of education in military history, and probably more than any time in my lifetime, we're talking a lot about militias, which tend to take on the personality of a loosely organized military apparatus. Tell us a little bit on your thinking of what we're seeing in that respect in Ohio and other states across the country.
Well, I should note that the militia movement is an extremist movement that has been around since late 1993. It's an anti-government extremist movement focused on particular anti-government conspiracy theories. It is, you know, substantially paramilitary in nature, in that the militia movement tends to organize around paramilitary groups and paramilitary activities, although not everybody in the movement does that. And Ohio was one of the first states where this movement began to emerge in the mid-1990s, and Ohio has had a significant amount of militia movement activity ever since.
Well, let's talk about Ohio specifically. The Southern Poverty Law Center recently ranked the Buckeye State as the second most extreme anti-government group population. This can't just be a circumstance of geography, right? Is there something that's taken place within the state's borders that has led the Southern Poverty Law Center to designate Ohio the second, number two in extremist anti-government groups?
I should note that we do not vouch for the Southern Poverty Law Center's lists of anti-government extremist groups. So you'd have to talk to them about their particular lists. It is true that anti-government extremism has a long history in Ohio, dating back to the 1970s, when the tax protest movement, the first of the major anti-government extremist movements, emerged, followed by the sovereign citizen movement and the militia movement. And, you know, often what makes a difference between one region or area and another as to whether one develops a strong or long history of that particular type of extremism is actually the presence of a few particularly active pioneers, leaders, or activists. Because, you know, we're talking about fringe and extremist groups, right? So we're talking about very small proportions of the population. We're not talking about, you know, huge mass movements. And so, you know, often a, you know, in a, let's say, central Ohio or southwestern Ohio, you know, the, it may be the presence or absence of a key organizer, a key figure that really makes a difference as to whether or not that particular movement becomes active in a particular area. And Ohio, unfortunately, you know, had enough of these pioneers and leaders that helped first, you know, generate some of these movements and then, you know, continue their activity over the years.
Well, we've seen anti-government extremists in the past, as you've noted. A lot of times people have dismissed those anti-government concerns as fringe. Over the past year during this pandemic, though, we have seen federal government, state and local governments take more extreme measures than we've witnessed in the past in an effort to mitigate the threat of this virus. I think a majority of people supported those efforts. But has this pandemic and the role of government within it, particularly related to the restrictions handed down to mitigate the spread of the virus, has that energized this militia movement, this extremist movement?
Certainly, the lockdown and other lockdown measures and other anti-pandemic measures were fodder for the militia movement and other anti-government extremists. I should note, though, that they're not, when I use the term anti-government extremists, I'm using this not in the sense of someone opposed to a particular law or policy or particular administration or just who wants less government or wants government off our backs. I'm actually referring to several movements that share a particular quality, which is that they actually believe that part or all of our government has actually been infiltrated, subverted, and essentially taken over by a conspiracy. And so what you and I might think of as the legitimate government in the eyes of someone in the militia movement or someone in the sovereign citizen movement is not actually the legitimate government at all.
We're talking with Dr. Mark Pitkavage. He is with the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism, where he is a senior research fellow. In addition to the pandemic, we saw what's been characterized as a reckoning on racial justice all across the country, including here in Ohio and various cities across the state. What role has the social justice movement in recent years played, if any, in inspiring any of this alternative messaging from extremist groups?
Well, the you know, Black Lives Matter and other groups that engaged in protests this past summer after the death of George Floyd, you know, caused a strong reaction from the far right in the United States. And the militia movement, for example, even though it's an anti-government extremist movement, not a white supremacist movement, nevertheless views Black Lives Matter as a movement controlled by Marxists and and so they came out in a number of places across the country, including Ohio, to sort of oppose or stare down Black Lives Matter activists in different areas. At the same time, though, and this just sort of illustrates what a complex landscape the far right has, a different anti-government extremist movement, a newer one that's only been around for a couple of years, the Boogaloo movement, which is intensely anti-authority and intensely anti-police, members of the Boogaloo movement, including in Ohio, you know, actually showed up at Black Lives Matter protests to support Black Lives Matter protesters because they viewed Black Lives Matter protesters as also opposed to the police, also angry at the police. And so they wanted to try to, you know, essentially make common cause with them, hop on their bandwagon, and, you know, try to, you know, exploit the anger that was generated this past summer against the police.
The Boogaloo group, these are the ones that might be identified by Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah, Boogaloers often wear Hawaiian shirts or may have flags or insignia with igloos as well. Both of those are actually plays on the term Boogaloo because Boogaloo sounds like big igloo. And it also sounds like big luau, which then that's why you get the Hawaiian stuff.
So Boogaloo boys, Proud Boys, three percenters, different militias. It's a lot to grapple with. Is there any danger to just mainstream Americans trying to grapple with the current situation? Because there are so many different types of messages out there, so many groups out there that it seems like it would be hard to keep track of, like what each of their motivations might be.
Well, it is hard to keep track of all the different far-right movements that are out there. And, you know, the average American is not going to be familiar with many of them. I think the one thing that I, and I don't think there's necessarily a need for the average American to be aware of every fringe movement out there. The one thing that I would point out is that a lot of people tend to conflate right-wing extremism with white supremacy. And actually, the far right includes, you know, a number of different movements, only some of which are actually white supremacist in nature. Some are anti-government in nature. Some are focused around other issues. And so, you know, if we just sort of think of right-wing extremism as only white supremacy and ignore the rest, then we're not necessarily successfully going to be able to deal with the problems those other types of extremists cause.
It seems that the federal government does have interest in dealing with the problem of the January 6th insurrection as it relates to the individuals involved. We've seen a lot of arrest. We expect a lot of prosecutions. What do we need to see come from those prosecutions in order for any necessary message to get through to people that perhaps this is not the type of behavior you should engage in?
Well, it would, you know, we're likely, you know, over the next year or so, first, we're likely to see a number of guilty pleas as some people try to escape consequences, the worst consequences for their behavior on January 6th. And the more guilty pleas we see, the more acknowledgement of guilt, that will be a good thing. And then trials will follow that for those who do not plead guilty. And obviously, the more convictions that prosecutors can secure, you know, that sends a stronger, you know, a very strong signal that, you know, we're not going to tolerate this sort of violence and mayhem that was caused on January 6th.
And as far as the future goes, is that the only tool that's at opposition, I guess, in the hands of the opposition to these right-wing extremists is just prosecution? Or do you see that there are other weapons to use against the rise in this? There's something to stem this tide?
Oh, there's a lot that can be done. I mean, one of the most important things that happened after January 6th was the huge backlash against the Stormers, as people from both parties and people in all sorts of positions of leadership and influence strongly condemned that sort of activity and those participants in no uncertain terms. And that sort of signal that our society will not sanction that type of activity really actually can play a role in dissuading people from that type of activity. It's not going to influence the most hardcore or fanatic people. But for those who fall below that high threshold, there would be some who actually could be dissuaded from doing things like that in the future, knowing that such acts would be condemned, not applauded.
Dr. Mark Pitkavage is with the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism, where he is a senior research fellow. Dr. Pitkavage, thank you so much for taking the time today and sharing some of your thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
And up next, we talk with Hamilton County Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey, who recently fired a deputy over his social media post in support of right-wing violence. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A Hamilton County Sheriff's deputy was ousted from his job following an investigation into his social media post in support of right-wing violence. It was not his first run-in with being disciplined for extreme behavior online. I spoke earlier with Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey about it, and here's our pre-recorded interview. Sheriff McGuffey, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you, Michael.
Sheriff, you recently fired a deputy, Michael Stemmerding, over violations of the sheriff's office's social media policy. He was expressing some views that many would understand to be right-wing extremists in support of this right-wing militia, the Three Percenters. What did this investigation tell you about your department, if anything?
Well, the investigation tells me exactly what I want to know, and that is accountability with our officers. And it accomplishes the objective that we came in with, which is to get the facts whenever there is a complaint and to act appropriately based on those facts as to what's appropriate in the sheriff's office regarding holding officers accountable.
This particular deputy had been reprimanded before in 2015 after sharing an Instagram post that was viewed as anti-Muslim and threatening to kill a Muslim if they were to show up at his door. Does the firing of this deputy represent a change from the previous administration to yours now that you're in leadership at the department?
Well, what I can speak to is exactly what I said on the campaign trail, which is transparency, accountability, and criminal justice reform. And I think that speaks to each of those three objectives. We're certainly going to take this office in a direction where officers are held accountable for their behavior, and that we communicate to the public in a very transparent way.
Do you have concern that there might be other deputies who share these views?
I do not know that there are any other deputies that share these views. I believe that all of the deputies that I know of and know about that hold a commission that is signed with my signature are following our oath of office, are following our rules and regulations, and I have every faith in our deputies. They're some of the most professional men and women in law enforcement, and I can very confidently speak very highly of all of them.
A lot of people who support these right-wing organizations that have emerged over the past several years have also been vocal supporters of the former president, Donald Trump. And at the same time, we heard the former president on the campaign trail talking about police officers and his support for police officers and that the law enforcement community supports him and his policies. Do you, as a longtime law enforcement professional, sense that there is a general, I guess, affection for this type of extremism within law enforcement in general?
I came into law enforcement as a person who joined the ranks because I want to be a professional, I want to do the right thing, I want to help society, and I want to be a representative that not only makes my community proud, but makes the nation proud of me. And I expect every deputy to conduct themselves in that way, regardless of who the president is, regardless of who the vice president is. Regardless of what politics play out in the United States or in this county, we are sworn to do one thing, and that thing is to uphold the law and act in a professional and a very transparent and accountable manner to the public. And that's exactly what I expect all of the officers to do who wear particularly the black and gold. And I know that we have many officers who joined the department for those very same reasons that I just said to you. We want to be here because it is our job to be the enforcement arm of law enforcement, and that's what we're here for and nothing else.
We're talking with Hamilton County Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey. As it relates to law enforcement and politics, law enforcement officers find themselves at the center of one of this nation's largest struggles right now. And in a year where we've grappled with a pandemic, we've also been dealing with what has been characterized as a reckoning on racial justice. And a lot of that has to do with the way law enforcement agencies have treated members, black members of our communities. Do you think that there's difficulty at all for law enforcement officers to understand what black people are talking about while also not being too defensive about their own profession and the way that they respond to these issues?
And that's a great question because it certainly is at the foremost of our minds right now. We have been through quite some very dramatic events in the United States in general and in different communities. And, you know, what I want to say is, you know, I took this job to bridge gaps. And I said that. I want to build bridges. I want to start with a community affairs unit. And I have, in fact, an African-American woman who was the first African-American woman promoted to major, Jackie Reed, who's in charge of that community affairs unit to work on just those issues. And I do think it's a communication issue. I think it's a reach across the aisle issue. I don't think it's a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. I think it is something that we all need to focus and work on and make sure that everybody feels equally represented in law enforcement.
Do you see any difficulty in getting the department more broadly involved in that? I know that you're the face of the agency and that any type of outreach to the community would more than likely represent your wishes of how you hope to connect to the community, how you hope the agency connects to the community. But what about the, you know, the rank and file deputies? Do you anticipate any difficulty in getting them on board?
You know, our deputies have always been known for their personalities, for using their manners when they get out of the car. Our deputies have always been known for their professional demeanor and their ability to intercede and de-escalate tight situations, whether it's with mentally ill people or having issues, someone who's struggling in life, whatever those situations are. And I believe that our deputies are exemplary in that way because they have the jail experience. You have to come through our jail before you can go on the street as a deputy. And those skills are built in a very confined and, quite frankly, interesting and challenging environment. And, you know, I do believe that our deputies are some of the best at doing that. I think that deputies follow what the boss sees as important. I think that's in any organization, any company, what the boss holds as the goals and the objectives is what everyone else wants to accomplish as well.
So while you work on building relationships between the community and the agency, what are the efforts internally? A lot of organizations, even, you know, Cincinnati Public Radio has looked at the events of last year and held intra-office meetings and had guest speakers come in to help us better understand what's happening. What are you doing internally in that respect?
We are doing training. We have embraced ABLE training, which is the ABLE acronym stands for Active Bystandership for Law Enforcement. And it is a way to train your people, and I do mean top to bottom, okay? We're going to start with the supervisors. In fact, our last staff meeting, we just outlined what schedule we will use to do that. We're going to start with the supervisors. We're going to train them up. I'm going to attend the class. Everybody in the organization will attend, our support staff, everyone. And we will talk in that class. It's an 8-hour training course, and we're going to talk about those sometimes hard conversations about diversity, about de-escalation, about doing the right thing when you're in uniform.
You've been in law enforcement a long time, Sheriff McGuffey, and I imagine, like a lot of industries, the reaction to certain behaviors, to certain comments that might have otherwise been tossed aside as locker room talk or just part of the day, the reaction towards those have changed. Can you talk a little bit about how you're seeing that change, if you're seeing it?
The reaction has changed. It's changed for a couple of different reasons, is my belief. And one is because the public has made it a issue by letting their voices be heard in peaceful protests, because people are speaking out and officers are speaking out about behavior they witnessed that was wrong behavior. I mean, the event of body cameras is changing the game for what the public sees in the way of transparency. Those kinds of things are educating the public as to what some of the issues are. And I believe most people in America agree we have an incarceration problem. We have an issue with our criminal justice system that needs to be fixed. And I think there are a lot of people working on fixing it. I see great gains, and I'm so optimistic about it. Everybody I've worked with, and I mean everybody, both sides of the aisle, are absolutely ready to help fix this issue.
Hamilton County Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey, thank you so much for the time you gave us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome, Michael. Thank you.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We turn now to the psychology behind extremism. And joining us is University of Maryland Professor of Psychology Ari Kruglansky. He's also the co-director of START, the National Center for the Study of Terrorism and the Response to Terrorism. Ari, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We're talking about modern, current cases of extremism, but you know Nazi extremism better than many of us, maybe all of us. And there's this photo of you that I have in the files as we were preparing for this conversation of you and two of your aunts marked with stars so that the Nazis could identify you as Jews. Would you mind just sharing a little bit of that story?
I was born in 1939, exactly the time where the Nazis invaded Poland. And immediately I was with my family transferred to the ghetto, the largest ghetto and the first ghetto in Poland at that time, the Lodz ghetto, where I remained for the first 5 years of my life. And, you know, originally the ghetto contained about 280,000 people. At the end, most of them perished in concentration camps. I was incredibly lucky, my family was, in that we were among the 800 families that remained as a working force for the German army. And that's how we survived.
Because there was a factory there that produced things for the Nazis, and your family was part of that.
Yes. My father was a director of the factory, and they were producing soles of shoes for German soldiers. So, you know, I was a kid. I was hidden because children were not allowed. And I miraculously survived to be able to tell you about it.
Well, you're a co-director of this organization called START, the National Center for the Study of Terrorism and the Response to Terrorism. Can you talk about how your experiences as a young boy in Nazi-occupied Europe has impacted the work that you've done as a professional?
It's very difficult to determine whether that's why I'm doing the work that I'm doing. For many years, I've done very different work. I'm a theoretical experimental psychologist that has been studying fundamental psychological processes. Only after 9/11, when I was invited to participate in the National Academies of Science panel to study terrorism, that I woke up to this issue. And from that time on, I've been researching it all over the world, in the Middle East, in Asia, Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, other places, Germany, of course, neo-Nazis, America. So this was not something that directly followed my experiences in the Second World War, but who knows, maybe that particular germ was inside of me, and when the opportunity came up, I resonated.
And despite the difficulties of this subject matter, you seem to have an optimistic approach that people can be saved from it. You're described as someone who believes that if there is an entrance to extremism, there must be an exit. Could you elaborate on that?
You know, extremism is a form of human behavior, and human behavior and human mind is malleable. It can be shaped in the same way as somebody becomes a radical, they can be deradicalized, and we've seen instances of that. They can also become radicalized. So the issue is understanding what's at the core of it. Previous speakers, Mark Pikavage, very interestingly described the complex landscape of current American extremism. But despite, we should not be blinded by the diversity, by the apparent diversity. You know, the more things change, the more they remain the same. The human nature has not changed. And there is a core dynamic to radicalization that, when understood, can provide the leverage for de-radicalization. And that dynamic consists of three elements in my research. One is the motivation. Everything that people do is motivated. So the question is, what underlies this motivation for extremism? And we find that it's a very fundamental quest for dignity and respect. President Biden never tires of talking about dignity and respect, and he really hits the nail on the head in this regard, because many social phenomena, revolutions, movements, Black Lives Matter, but also Proud Boys, also the Three Percenters, they're all about dignity. So the question is, how do you channel this universal quest for respect and dignity that everybody has? And that's where the narrative comes in. You are exposed to a narrative that promises you dignity. That narrative can be pro-social, can be constructive, can be humanistic, or it can be violent. It can identify an enemy, an imagined, alleged enemy that is endangering America, endangering the country, endangering our culture, and that enemy has to be fought. So there is the need, there is the narrative, and the third end in this 3N triumvirate is the network, the social movement that validates the narrative. And unfortunately, that social movement in America has been intensifying. But this is the, you know, this, these are the elements, the pillars of radicalization. To understand how to de-radicalize people, you have to reverse that process. You have to still address that fundamental need for dignity, because that's immutable. That's part of human nature. Find a different narrative that is credible and it promises people dignity in constructive pro-social means. And you have to create a movement that would endorse that narrative. Things have been going the other way in the last several years, but understanding it provides a guide and a leverage for making the effort to reverse it, because otherwise things can deteriorate even more than they have so far.
We're talking with Ari Kruglansky, the co-director of START, the National Center for the Study of Terrorism and the Response to Terrorism. He's also a professor of psychology at the University of Maryland. Ari, you referenced our first guest on today's program, Mark Pitkavage, who is with the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism, where he is a senior research fellow. And we talked about some of the different types of right-wing extremist groups that exist out there, but also that such extremism has existed in spurts over the decades. I'm wondering what your thoughts are now from a psychological standpoint. Is it because such information, disinformation, and incorrect motivations are so easily delivered to people now through social media platforms? Do you see that playing a significant role in the rise of right-wing extremism in America today?
It does. But I think that this movement toward extremism has been occurring over the last several decades. The economic crisis that befell the world, the immigration crisis, the refugee crisis in Europe, and now the pandemic, it all contributed to a sense of uncertainty, to a sense of anxiety, and from a psychological perspective, to a sense of fragility, the sense of disempowerment, the sense of lost significance, lost dignity. And so this has been happening over time. The last 4 years, it has been supported politically to a large extent. And of course, we have had the pandemic that contained multiple stressors. So all of this contributed to the intensification of this movement. In addition, there's been another set of phenomena that have been occurring gradually, and that's the gradual loss of trust in public institutions, in the media, in the government, in the Congress, in the Supreme Court, in the police, in science. So once you have this deterioration of trust in public institutions, alternative sources of information gain significance, gain ascendance. And that's why you have this proliferation of conspiracy theories that now become credible because you do not have a credible source of information that is central, that is trusted by all, to counter it. So, yes, and the social media, of course, are very important, because whereas before, a leader, in order to influence an audience, had to speak to the audience in the marketplace. Over time, we have had radio, we have had television. Now we have the social media that multiply the message. They can tweet and retweet and re-retweet. So the message gets amplified by manifold, and therefore its impact is also greater by manifold.
Ari, I imagine that political differences have been a thing of families' dinner tables for millennia. Looking at a set of facts and possibly falling on different sides of, you know, outcomes and opinions based on those facts, and possibly creating some tension among loved ones. But now we are living in a climate where you're seeing close relationships torn apart because one or more people involved in those relationships doesn't believe in the facts and instead believes with all their heart in a big lie. So if you're able to bring people back from these extremist views, how do you start?
One thing is to cool down the rhetoric, because the frenzy, the great intensity of the rhetoric, of the narrative, multiplies the tendency to become extreme. We know it from psychology, including animal literature, that the greater the arousal, the greater the emotional upheaval, the greater the tendency to go with the impulse, with the dominant response. So I think that intensity is detrimental. We've got to, and secondly, part of the problem that fuels extremism is real world social problems. We have a pandemic that has to be taken care of, because it creates the kind of loss of significance and fragility that makes people vulnerable to extremist ideation, extremist rhetoric. We have economic crisis because of the pandemic that has to be taken care of, because again, it contributes to people's sense of fragility and disempowerment. So, you know, cool the rhetoric, be pragmatic, take care of the economy and the pandemic, and also propagate narratives that are pro-social. Mark Pikavich talked about the outrage against the storming of the Capitol. That's the kind of alternative narrative that has to be propagated. But, you know, it's not something that that can be solved by a silver bullet. It's not something that a bunch of social scientists or psychologists can cure. It has to be an effort made by the whole society. There has to be a political will. It has to be carried out in the police. The sheriff talked about, you know, the changes in the police that are all very important. It has to be in community centers, in the educational centers, in immigration policy. It has to be a whole society effort. We know what to do to address people's need for dignity and significance in ways that will not be fragmented and creating divisions and conflict and violence.
We are talking with Ari Kruglansky, co-director of START, the National Center for the Study of Terrorism and the Response to Terrorism. He is also a University of Maryland psychology professor. You referenced some of the methods by which the government could address some of these extremist views and how to help rehabilitate people. I'm wondering, though, because you also mentioned that people have a depleted trust in traditional government institutions. So how can you expect extremists to pay attention to some of the government's attempts to remedy the current crisis we face socially in this country if they don't trust them to begin with?
Trust has to be rebuilt, and trust will be rebuilt when people's problems are addressed and when voice is given to alternative narratives. It's not going to be easy. Because once the trust is lost, it's very difficult to rebuild it. But we must do all we can to rebuild it. Vindictiveness, demonization of the other side is something that has to stop, because that fuels fractionation, it fuels fission, it fuels deterioration of the common core of America. So all of these things have to happen again on all levels of society. It's not something that can be done overnight. It has to be an effort that is systematic and gradual and all levels of society. But we do not have any alternative. However difficult it is, the alternative is the abyss. The alternative is what happened in Germany in the 1930s and 40s. We must not allow this extremism to creep into the center of American life, into the center of American politics. It has to be resisted. It has to be cooled down. It has to be addressed pragmatically.
You saw what the Nazis did firsthand back then, and you just referenced it as, you know, something similar as a possibility here. I want to reiterate that point because it's striking. What are the signs you're seeing?
Well, the signs I'm seeing is that extremism is creeping into the center of American politics. The Republican Party has been drawn into this extremism of winning by any price. It doesn't matter as long as it's a winning stratagem. They seem to be willing to support it. There is an affinity between conservatism as a psychological state of mind and these extreme movements, in the sense that conservatism is against change. So, you know, it's against the changing status of women and minorities in our society. Conservatism is against diversity because diversity reduces a common understanding. It introduces other voices that may need to be dealt with. It is against a global government because a global government is by definition more diverse than a local government. So all these elements that are part of the conservative state of mind and are an important basis for in the Republican Party are very sympathetic to movements that are against government, against diversity, against change. So there is an affinity there. But in addition, the extremism of winning by any price that started perhaps in the 1990s with the Contract of America, it continued with the Tea Party movement, and now we have idea that the elections were stolen and that whole idea that the government is illegitimate. That's part of that narrative in understanding of some members of the party is a winning strategy to regain power in 2024.
Ari Kruglansky, thank you so much for the time you gave us. Really appreciate your story.
Thank you very much.